From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I appeal the people of USA and the government USA to do not recognize President Habibi before he seriously say will hold general election next year.
A conversation with freed Indonesian labor leader Mukhtar Pakpahan. The U.S. priest forced out of Cuba speaks on radio for the first time. And as the world focuses on Pakistan's nuclear tests, we'll look at a nuclear controversy here at home, a debate on the mobile Chernobyl bill. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former Black Panther Geronimo Pratt, freed after 27 years behind bars, has sued the FBI and the Los Angeles Police Department, claiming the agencies withheld evidence that proved his innocence. In the civil rights lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court yesterday, Geronimo Gijaga, formerly known as Elmer Geronimo Pratt, claimed he was framed for a 1968 murder he didn't commit. The lawsuit alleges malicious prosecution as well as evidence tampering. This according to a law firm associate of Johnny Cochran, who represents Pratt in Los Angeles. Pratt was arrested in 1970 and charged with murdering teacher Carolyn Olson in a robbery on a Santa Monica tennis court. Pratt maintained he was in Oakland attending Black Panther meetings at the time of the slaying, and that FBI agents hid and possibly destroyed the wiretap evidence that would prove it. The suit also states that prosecutors presented false evidence during Pratt's trial. It took 28 years to convict the man who killed civil rights leader Medgar Evers. The family of his colleague, Vernon Dahmer, hopes justice is finally catching up with his killers, too. Dahmer's family said the recent conviction of Byron de la Beckwith and Evers' death encouraged them to push Mississippi investigators to reopen the case against suspects in Dahmer's death. Former Ku Klux Klan imperial wizard Sam Bowers and two other men were jailed yesterday in the 1966 firebomb death of Dahmer, who was targeted because he offered to let blacks pay poll tax at his store. Bowers, one-time head of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and Charles Noble are accused of murder and arson under indictment shelved since the late 60s and reactivated on Wednesday. The nation's biggest black attorneys group has reportedly withdrawn a speaking invitation to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. The conservative black justice was to address the annual convention of the National Bar Association's Judicial Council in July in Memphis. But a member told the Richmond Times-Dispatch of Richmond, Virginia, that the council voted overwhelmingly this week to rescind the invitation. The paper says the snub follows intense debate and lobbying in the organization, which also opposed Thomas's 1991 appointment to the high court. Last year, Thomas withdrew from speaking at a Delaware youth festival after the local NAACP threatened a protest. In international news, Pakistan today denied reports that it's fitting nuclear warheads to its Gauri missile, which Islamabad says has the range hit deep inside arch-rival India. A foreign ministry statement called patently wrong newspaper reports that quoted an official statement as saying Pakistan was preparing to arm the Gowri, which was test-fired last month. Pakistan announced yesterday it had conducted 5 nuclear test blasts, its first in response to a similar number by India earlier this month. The news fanned fears of an Asian arms race and brought swift economic sanctions from Japan and the United States. This despite the fact that in the United States, the U.S. Senate has yet to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Tomorrow, the Pentagon will stage a 10-hour mock invasion, hostage-taking, and chemical attack. It's designed to test how well civilian emergency units respond to certain crises. Officials say 700 volunteers from federal and local agencies will take part. The scenario involves a radical group demanding U.S. intervention in a country threatening to use weapons of mass destruction. Officials say the exercise was planned before India and Pakistan entered into a nuclear arms race. Half the 18 million residents of Mexico City are suffering health problems because of the dangerous levels of smog, and health complaints have risen 27% in the past week. Mexico City declared a fourth day of smog emergency, cutting the number of cars on the streets by more than 1 million, forcing the district's factories to cut back on output and urging people to keep indoors. 7,000 feet up in the mountains and nestled in a large valley that traps fumes from the metropolis's 3 million cars and 60,000 factories, Mexico City has long suffered from serious serious pollution. The smog has been exacerbated this year by smoke from forest fires sparked by a prolonged drought, in turn caused by the El Nino weather phenomenon. The smoke from blazing forests across Mexico and throughout Central America has triggered environmental alerts in several Mexican states and has reached as far as Texas, causing authorities there to urge school children to stay indoors. American unions are testing a new tool to improve conditions of migrant workers in the United States, the North American Free Trade Agreement they so strenuously opposed. Using provisions from a side agreement to the pact, four Mexican unions, aided by their U.S. counterparts, filed a complaint in Mexico this week, charging that migrant workers in Washington state have been denied their rights. Most of the estimated 45,000 migrant workers who pick and pack apples in Washington are Mexican. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, rejoined after a couple of weeks by my co-host Juan Gonzalez, who is a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and it's good to be back after being hidden away at home trying to finish this book that I've been that is due to my publisher. So it's done finally and will be delivered today, and I'm back and glad to be with all the listeners again.
And the title?
Oh, A Harvest of Empire.
And it's about Latinos.
It's about Latinos
in
America, right? A story sort of looking at all the various Latino groups who have come to this country, how they got here, and the process of our integration into the rest of American society, or lack of integration.
Well, I really look forward to reading it. And I have another question for you, Juan. Is it true you just dove in?
Amy, you would have to ask this question, wouldn't you? yes, I did, and it's all that too is done, and I'm glad that's out of the way.
Now, we have to explain a little for our listeners who may not have caught on, but you know the ongoing saga of Juan getting his college degree after 30 years. He was a leader of the Columbia student strike in 1968, and that all led to him not getting his degree. We've discussed in the last weeks of how he finished a physics paper 30 years later to get that degree, and you thought you were going to graduate with the class of 1998, Juan. Is that right, until you got a call?
That's right. About 3 days before the Columbia graduation, I get a call from the phys ed department telling me that they have checked my records and that I never passed a required swimming test that is a requirement of graduation. And I said, I'm 50 years old. You're telling me I have to jump in a pool to get my degree? And they said, sure, it's still the requirement. So I did it. I went down there 2 days before graduation and passed my swimming test.
Well, How many laps?
Along with a few other 1998 graduates who were old enough to be my children, or young enough to be my children.
How many laps?
It was 3 laps on the Olympic pool. I did Amy, okay? That was my best stroke, all right?
Is it true, since I've spoken with the phys ed coach, that you look like you're about to have a heart attack at the end of it?
Yeah, he did keep saying, are you okay, sir? Are you all right, sir?
Well, I'm glad that you're doing just swimmingly and that you have now graduated from college.
Thank you, Amy. Appreciate it.
Now to some more serious matters. Well, we certainly have been covering over the last 2 days and actually over the last weeks the India nuclear test and then yesterday 5 nuclear test blasts that were done by Pakistan. And we talked extensively about that yesterday on Democracy Now! With Indian and Pakistani scientists. Well, today we're going to look a little closer to home. We're going to look at a nuclear controversy in this country. This year, the federal government plans to begin the first of 30,000 nuclear waste shipments across 22 states to the waste isolation plant in New Mexico. Congress also plans to decide whether to make thousands of shipments of irradiated or spent fuel from commercial nuclear power plants across 43 states and dozens of Indian reservations to Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Anti-nuclear activists and environmentalists say these shipments will not solve the nation's real problem, the absence of a scientifically sound, democratically adopted policy to deal with nuclear waste. They say that instead, the shipments could endanger millions of people along transportation routes through exposure to radioactive materials while creating newly contaminated sites in New Mexico and Nevada. Well, next Tuesday, Congress is expected to vote on a nuclear waste bill that would begin moving nuclear waste on our highways and railroads in the next 5 years. And we're joined now by two people on different sides of this issue. Ana Aurelio is with us from U.S. PIRG. She's a staff scientist there. And we're also joined by Steve Caracas of the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is a nuclear trade group in Washington, D.C. Steve Caracas, why don't we start with you? Why don't you tell us why, how you feel about this bill?
Well, it's nice to be in the lion's den coming off, Amy, of that wonderfully slanted introduction. What you've got here is legislation to end a ripoff of ratepayers around the country. Right now, the federal government has defaulted on a longstanding legal obligation to move used fuel away from commercial reactors. They are in default, opening the door to potentially tens of billions of dollars in liability to taxpayers nationwide. They seem not to give a darn at all. And so this is legislation that we vitally need to protect a critical part of our electricity supply that's crucial to our clean air goals, namely nuclear power. And I think all the rhetoric that I've been hearing about mobile Chernobyl and so forth is really a bunch of garbage. This isn't the Soviet Union, and the program's not being run by Nikita Khrushchev or Mikhail Gorbachev. So we can just put that away right off the bat.
Well, Ana Aurelio, I think it's your group, U.S. PIRG and others, that call it the Mobile Chernobyl Bill. Why do you call it that?
Absolutely. Nuclear waste is some of the most dangerous stuff that we have on Earth. Just a few seconds of exposure to unshielded fuel rods when they come out of a reactor will deliver a lethal dose. We need to be very, very careful about how we deal with this stuff. And the nuclear industry simply wants to dump its waste on us, the taxpayer. And in the process, they want to preempt state, local, and some federal environmental laws. This is the most reckless thing that we can do with this very, very dangerous material. It's absolutely irresponsible. It is not a solution to the nuclear waste problem.
Well, if we didn't have 30 years of experience actually transporting used fuel, then there might be some shred of truth in what Anna just said, but in fact, that's not the case. This is the biggest case of been there, done that in terms of managing the issue very safely. We've had over 2,500 shipments of used fuel around the country over the past 25 to 30 years. And the reason people don't know about that is because it's been done so safely. There hasn't been any kind of incident that would ever have been a concern.
I'd like to ask Mr. Caracas. Now, you're saying that...
Caracas, thank
Caracas,
you.
Caracas, I'm sorry. I'd like to ask you, in terms of you say that there is a legal obligation of the federal government to transport this fuel. Could you explain to our listeners a little bit what the basis of that legal obligation
sure,
is?
Sure, Juan. In 1982, Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and basically established that as of January 31, 1998, the Energy Department would begin to move used fuel away from reactor sites to a central repository. And in fact, the site that's being studied is the remote desert area about 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas. The site of, it's the Nevada test site, the site of many atomic tests over the years. I mean, extremely unpopulated. The all signs thus far look very good. You've had many federal officials testify in Congress. There are no showstoppers so far. They have not actually finished their scientific testing thus far. But, you know, they are well along, and at this point, signs look good. But this is an obligation that stems from 1982, and as a result of that, consumers of nuclear-generated electricity have paid into the federal government now specifically for the Nuclear Waste Management Program on the order of about $14 billion. And again, as of January 31, the federal government simply threw up its hands and said, gee, we don't have a solution for you. We're not going to tell you when or if we're going to have one at all. So we've got now the door open to potentially tens of billions of dollars in liability to taxpayers, and we've got no federal leadership, certainly not from the White House, which is threatening to veto this legislation. We've got a solution on the table that has tremendous bipartisan support in Congress. More than 300 votes in the House of Representatives last fall, 65 votes in the Senate about a year ago this time. Strong bipartisan support because, in fact, there's been a very rigorous bipartisan legislative process that has addressed virtually any kind of concern anyone can come up with.
And
if this site is so safe, Why do you have to preempt critical environmental laws? What the nuclear industry is doing here is, one, they want to shunt their dangerous nuclear waste onto taxpayers' hand. This bill takes the liability for the nuclear waste right off the nuclear industry's hands and puts it squarely on us, the U.S. taxpayers. Next, what it does is it changes the rules for the permanent repository. As I said, this is some of the most dangerous stuff we have on Earth, and this bill preempts critical environmental laws that would protect the public from this dangerous material. This stuff remains dangerous for more than a quarter of a million years. If this bill is so great, why do you have to preempt environmental laws?
We're not
if Yucca
preempting.
Mountain
there
is
are,
so
there
safe,
are, there
why
are
do you
myths.
Have to keep changing the rules? Steve, you guys are changing the rules as soon as there's a problem with Yucca Mountain. And by the way, it's not a safe site so far. There are earthquake faults lying underneath it. There's indications that there was groundwater moving through that. It's not a safe site so far. There are many, many questions. The jury is still out. Why do you think the federal government hasn't yet decided it's the place to go?
Because
we have to keep this
government.
Stuff safe for a quarter of a million years. We have never done this kind of engineering before. And this site, there are a lot of questions about it. The nuclear industry simply wants to wash its hands of the entire matter.
But
this is an absolutely dangerous bill.
I'd like to ask you, what would you expect the nation do with the nuclear waste that continues to accumulate? Clearly, something has to be done with it.
Clearly, something has to be done with it, but the nuclear industry has manufactured a crisis. They're saying that nuclear waste is building up at nuclear power plants around the country, and somehow they have to move it as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, they're continuing to operate their dangerous and expensive reactors, and nuclear waste will continue to accumulate. This bill doesn't magically remove nuclear waste from sites around the country.
Nuclear power has a sterling safety record in this country. Sterling.
Oh, please.
And
talk to the people who live around 3 miles Island, Steve.
Well, I'd be happy
to, because in fact,
there's been any number of scientific studies that have shown that as a result of Three Mile Island, there was no environmental damage done. And if that's the best you can come up with, then you need to go dig some more.
And in fact, talk to me about why both Maine Yankee and the Yankee Row nuclear power plants in New England have both been permanently shut down.
Because we are entering something called deregulation. I realize that a free market in the business world is something that's unusual to you, but in fact, we're entering a deregulated electricity market, and so you have not just some nuclear plants that are being closed. You've got any number of fossil plants that are being closed around the country as well. In fact,
Steve, the nuclear industry doesn't want a free market. They want a bailout for their very expensive nuclear power plants. You guys are asking for $100 billion-plus bailout of your nuclear power plants. You don't want a bailout. You guys don't care about ratepayers. You care about your profits, and you want to get rid of the liability for this very dangerous waste and shunt it onto the public.
I want to ask each of you a final question. It has to do with where the bill now stands in Congress. Steve Karakas of the Nuclear Energy Institute, a nuclear trade group, how do you see the votes lining up? And also just tell us the number of the bill.
The bill number that will be considered in the Senate in the next few weeks is H.R. 1270. There's going to be strong support there, really, except for Nevada. We wouldn't expect to get them, but there's no reason for any of the other 98 senators not to support this legislation, because it already has strong bipartisan support. It's a solution for an environmental challenge that is critical and is broadly supported because it has been through a rigorous legislative process, and it's going to be a great thing for this country.
Anna Aurelio, how do you see the votes lining up, and who do you see as the key players on this?
Well, we're very, very happy that the Clinton administration realizes that this bill is dangerous and reckless for the American public and has promised to veto the bill. We have 34 votes in the Senate. That's enough to uphold a promised presidential veto. And those senators that oppose the bill rightfully are trying to protect the American public and not just bail out the nuclear industry.
So what are you recommending people do?
We are recommending that senators vote no. We are recommending that citizens around the country, remember, this waste will move through 43 states. This stuff is extremely dangerous. Local emergency responders aren't trained, aren't ready to deal with accidents of this extremely dangerous materials. We're recommending that people around the country call their senators and say no, no to mobile Chernobyl.
We
don't need this bill. This is a reckless and dangerous bill.
Tremendous track record, 2,500 shipments over 30 years. We've done it. We know how to do it. We can do it.
In the first 3 years alone, more waste would head on our highways and railroads than in the entire preceding 30 years. Even the Department of Energy admits that accidents will happen.
We're talking about one shipment a day. One shipment a day. That's what it works out
to. Why do you have to preempt state and local laws? If this is so safe, why are you preempting state and local laws, Steve? Admit it. It's not safe.
If people want to get more information on this bill, why don't you each give out a website and a phone number? We'll start with Steve Karakis of the Nuclear Energy Institute.
Phone number 202-739-8000, 739-8000. The website, www.nei.org. We very much appreciate your time.
Thank you. And Anna Aurelio of the U.S. PERG.
U.S. PERG's phone number is 202-546-9707. Our website is www.perg.org. P-I-R-G is how you spell it.
That's for Public Interest Research Group. Well, I thank you both very much for joining us, and we will watch this bill closely as it moves through the Senate next week. Expected vote is on Tuesday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going international. We're going to take a look at Indonesia, a conversation with the freed labor leader there, Mukhtar Pakpahan. We'll look at who B.J. Habibie is, and then we're going to speak with a U.S. priest, the only one allowed in Cuba. He was recently kicked out. It'll be his first radio interview. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Boy, Juan, since we last were together, major events have taken place in the world. In Indonesia, the dictator was forced out by the pro-democracy movement. And it's been quite amazing to watch what has happened there since. Some feel that the face change from Suharto to his appointed predecessor, to his appointed successor, Habibie, has not been a very significant change. But we are watching events closely as students continue to protest. Yesterday, they rallied outside the parliament in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, chanting, "Bring down Habibie right now." The new leader has said that he will be holding parliamentary elections next year. He also freed a handful of political prisoners before the IMF representatives came to speak with him. The pair released yesterday, a journalist and a political activist were jailed for speaking out against Suharto's theft of the nation's wealth and the kidnapping and torture of dissidents by his military regime, the same military that remains there today. Well, labor activist Mukhtar Pakpahan spent nearly 2 years in prison on a bogus charge of fomenting riots. Since his release on Tuesday, Pakpahan has been meeting nonstop with ambassadors, union members, democracy activists, and seeing family. We can certainly attest to that because between Democracy Now! And the Pacifica Network News, we have been calling him nonstop over the last few days, talking with his family, and he has been in meetings from early in the morning till late at night. Well, last night, Pacifica's Julie Drizin finally did catch up with him at the end of a very long day for him in Jakarta, and this is what he had to say.
It's been a few days since you were released from prison. How does it feel?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm happy, but I am tired.
So Yusuf Habibie has now taken office. Tell us about Habibie.
Habibie is a person who was
and is very close to Suharto. And personally, he is also the resource of collusion, corruption, and nepotism. And his cabinet, still majority are Suharto's cadre, Suharto's person.
Now, you are the head of the Indonesian Labor Welfare Union, an independent union that was banned and not recognized by President Suharto. Has Habibie recognized your union?
Up to now, not yet, but his minister, the new minister of manpower, Fahmi Idris, has said in television that he will ratify ILO Convention number 87, and then no problem anymore, the freedom to associate and to build a new union, more than one.
Are you feeling free to speak openly about what's happening in Indonesia?
Yes, as long as today, I am feeling that I am really a free man. Mm-hmm. I am not fear to say anything. I am not fear to say what in my heart. So it is also as consequently of the reformation is going on.
Now, I understand that the International Monetary Fund is meeting in Jakarta with Indonesian officials. Have you spoken to them about the loans to Indonesia?
Not yet, but according to the agenda, tomorrow I will make a meeting with him, with NIS.
What are you planning to say to the International Monetary Fund?
I am planning to say, do not give the aid, the loan, if no political reformation yet. Because if the IMF give the aid, corruptors still be there, and then they will corrupt the money, and then the people never take advantage or benefit from the money.
And I understand that there are still some students who are demonstrating outside Parliament.
Today, yes. Mm-hmm. And maybe next week we will organize the big demonstration again, because we demand that next month there will be a special assembly. But it seems President Habibie and Chairman of Parliament refused to do that. And they said the special assembly, special general assembly, will be next January. And then the general election a year after that. So it is mean 2 years more we run the general election. So because, and I know that Suharto is behind the concept, behind the program. So we have to organize the demonstration to force Habibie and Parliament to hold special general assembly.
Will you be running for office?
I am a unionist. Mm-hmm. I will continuously struggle as a unionist. I think I will not be a politician, but struggle better as a unionist than a politician. But except if the people need me to do that.
Is there anything else that you would like to say about the current situation in Indonesia today?
I appeal the people of USA and the government USA to do not recognize President Habibie before he seriously say will hold general election next year. Because if he will not hold the general election, It is mean the political situation in Indonesia unpredictable and still unrest. And it is mean too that the people will be more suffering.
And that was Indonesian labor activist and former political prisoner Mokhtar Pakpahan speaking with Pacifica's Julie Drizin late yesterday. Actually, it's interesting because today in Congress there will be a briefing looking at what the U.S. should do now to promote a democratic and peaceful transition in Indonesia, what the IMF's role in Indonesia's economic collapse, and under what conditions should the loan be resumed. Among those who will be testifying are the RFK Memorial Center for Human Rights, the Institute for Policy Studies, the East Timor Action Network, Development Gap, Friends of the Earth, and the Asia Director of the AFL Solidarity Center. It's being sponsored by Pete DeFazio, a Democratic Congress member, as well as Bernie Sanders, the Independent of Vermont, and Dennis Kucinich, new Congress member, Democrat from Ohio. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're joined now on the telephone by Jeff Winters. He's a professor of political economy at Northwestern University. He's been studying Indonesia for 18 years. He just recently returned from there. And we want to talk more about what is happening there right now and who exactly the new leader of Indonesia, B.J. Habibie, is. He was appointed by the dictator Suharto when he was forced out last week. Habibie has been described almost as a son to Suharto. In his autobiography, Suharto wrote, "Habibie regards me as his own parent. He always asks for my guidance and takes down notes of my philosophy." This week's Time magazine profile of Habibie notes his slavish devotion to the man he called SGS, super genius Suharto. Well, Professor Winters, why don't we start off with you giving us your profile of this man and if you think he's going to last very long.
Well, the second part first. I don't think he's going to last very long, for two reasons. For the political, for the immediate political reasons that Mokhtar Pakpahan just gave, which is that I believe there are going to be ongoing demands that are going to intensify as it becomes clear that Habibie really does represent tremendous continuity and virtually no change. But also for the reason that Indonesian society is still feeling a tremendous amount of pain and because of the economic crisis, and I think that's going to get worse before it gets better, and there's no legitimacy on the part of Habibie.
Professor Winters, I'd like to ask you, in the accounts, the news accounts that I've seen of Indonesia, there are always references by the reporters in Washington to our government's sense that the military is the only reliable institution in the country, the only one that has the support of the people. In your study of Indonesia, is that your sense as well?
Well, there's been a disturbing trend in not just in Washington but in the media all over, which is to try to cast the head of the armed forces, General Wiranto, who did, in the final hours, help push Suharto from power. And there's been this effort to try to cast him in this heroic light. But what we really need to understand is that this is a Suharto loyalist. This is someone who only took the actions that he did because the Indonesian population pushed him in a direction or changed his range of options in such a way that he really had to turn on the man who had made his career. So the Indonesian military, up until very recently, was very happy to stay with Suharto, the New Order, and the whole program that had been going on for several decades. So this institution is a suspicious institution in the view of, I think, most of the Indonesian people, and doesn't enjoy legitimacy. A lot of people see getting the military out of government and even getting this set of generals who head the military out of power as part of the full process of undoing Suharto and the New Order.
You know, Professor Winters, regular listeners to Democracy Now! And people who, you know, have been following Indonesia and East Timor closely know a great deal about what the military has done there over the last 32 years of the Suharto reign. But because it's being whitewashed out of the media, and as you say, Wiranto is being cast as a moderate, despite that he told the students before it looked like they were going to push Suharto out, that they would have to face the wrath of the Indonesian military and that the Indonesian military would shoot them. Can you talk about the history of the military?
Oh, well, this is a military which practically from the very beginning, you know, they started out opposing the Dutch, and that was the only sort of internal struggle that they really engaged in that had an external dimension to it. Everything else after that was all about either expanding into East Timor or controlling the society's people. The Indonesian military doesn't have any major external threats, and so all the training they've undergone has been about controlling the population, psyops, urban terrain combat, and those kinds of things. This is a military which carried out in the early 1980s, a huge massacre in Jakarta in the port district of Tanjung Priok. This is the same military which carried out what were called the mysterious killings, where several thousand people were also killed in the 1980s under General Benny Mordaunt. It's a military which, as you said a moment ago, right up to the end, was using words like cut to pieces or mow down were the kinds of verbs that were being used in public statements by the commanders of the armed forces for anyone who would stand in the way of the status quo government. And so really, for the Indonesian people to stand up to Suharto and this military was an act of tremendous courage, because they had demonstrated many times in the past a willingness and an ability to unleash tremendously brutal force. And the military is still full of lots of figures who, by any standard globally, qualify as people who are criminals against humanity and would be brought in a tribunal, would be brought up on charges and found guilty.
Another viewpoint that I've seen in several reports is that the market forces around the world actually helped to bring this democratic change about. That in essence, that the pressures on Suharto and the Indonesian elite to end their total corruption in financial and business dealings was what created the conditions for this. Is that your assessment as well?
Well, you know, I would admit that the fickleness and the unpredictability and the sloshing nature of global financial capital as it is in the late 1990s or at the turn of the century now is certainly played a role in undermining the Suharto regime. But to credit a system where you have these massive regime destabilizing kinds of movements of capital, region destabilizing movements of capital, with having a kind of democratic motive to them is, I think, completely wrong. This is the very same global business community which, up until this point, has been working very closely with all of the authoritarian regimes in the Asia region, including the Suharto regime. So it's not as if, just because starting with the Thai baht last July, which triggered at the psychological level the sort of onset of the Asian crisis, it's not as if all these business people who had been making super profits under authoritarian regimes in Asia suddenly changed their mind about their role politically in the region and decided, well, we really ought to get behind democracy at this point. It's only that there were movements on hand which once, for reasons that had nothing to do with democracy, once capital destabilized several of these regimes, including Suharto's, there were people who were ready to take advantage of it. But that, to give an intentionality to it, as some people are trying to do, is really, I think, a problem.
And quickly, if you can comment on Suharto's wealth. We have the latest news reports that his family members are being forced to step down from various heads of boards of the largest companies like Bimantara Sitra as protesters call for an investigation into the wealth of Suharto. I mean, it's a sad comment that it wasn't Suharto's brutality that brought him down. As you say, the world continued to support him, at least the economic leaders in the world. But it was the issue of the wealth and the corruption.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd just like to note for your listeners that I've been thinking about this for quite a while, and I cannot come up with another case where you have a leader like Suharto who is brutal and intimidating to his population for years and years and years, who steals from society on such a staggering scale in the tens of billions of dollars, if you combine all of it together with his family, who then is toppled by a widespread and deep and angry, really, social movement, but then who manages to stay in country. I mean, I can't think of another case that's quite like it, although a friend of mine said Nixon would be a comparison. But really, I can't think of a case like this. And it speaks volumes, because that the Suharto family doesn't feel truly frightened to the point where they need to scurry out of the country and find some place that's willing to take them, shows that Habibi and all the rest have given strong assurances that they will protect the Suharto family. And it also signifies that the government believes that the movement has lost momentum. For the while, maybe it has. But one of the things that I would just say quickly in closing is that the movement that toppled Suharto was a primarily elitist movement. It involved elite students. It involved elite actors. And the next step is going to take a much more grassroots foundation, and that is the election and moving Indonesia in a genuinely democratic direction.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Jeff Winters of Northwestern University, for being with us. Professor Winters, a professor of political economy in Chicago, and has been studying Indonesia for the past two decades. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be talking about Cuba with a U.S. priest who was until recently a priest in Cuba. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we've just gotten news that Pope John Paul is planning to meet with Cuban priests in June to discuss what has been happening in Cuba since his trip there. It's been 5 months since Pope John Paul II visited Cuba, the first visit ever of any pope to the island nation. One of the people who received quite a bit of media attention during and after that visit is Catholic priest Patrick Sullivan from the Bronx in New York. Father Sullivan was the first U.S. priest to have a parish in Cuba since the revolution in 1959. He worked as the pastor of Iglesia La Pastora in Santa Clara, Cuba, for more than 3 years before leaving Cuba last month. Sullivan says the government forced him out because of his contacts with foreign media and his outspokenness on issues of liberty. But the Cuban government claims it was the decision of the church. We're now joined right now by Father Patrick Sullivan in his first radio interview, and we welcome you to Democracy Now.
Thank you.
Maybe you can tell us, Father Sullivan, how you first came to work in Cuba.
Well, I had been working in different countries in Central America for about 20 years. So I was finishing a commitment in El Salvador at that time and basically went to Cuba to replace some Central American priests who were returning to Central America as a rotation of personnel.
And it was unusual even to be admitted. Was there any particular process that occurred for the Cuban government to allow you into the country after so many years of Americans, priests not serving in Cuba?
No, we were sort of surprised that I was accepted. They put my name in as a possibility, and it was simply accepted. I was granted a 5-year residency, but no particular process or explanation of why, so we just accepted it happily, and I started working there.
And in terms of the your ministry there, when did you first start having some kind of problems in your ministry in Santa Clara?
I think the only problems really came up after I gave an interview to a Boston Globe reporter, Steve Feineru, and he printed what I thought was a very balanced article. But the government there is extremely sensitive to what they would consider negative publicity. So there was a lot of negative reaction after that article. So that pretty much was all downhill from there as far as relations with the party.
What did you say?
Well, actually, most of the – since it was an article for a U.S. paper, more than half the article was my criticisms of the U.S. Embargo on a moral, ethical basis. But since he also mentioned that there were some activities in the parish, that we had a committee that worked with prisoners and their families, that the people were very pleased to democratically elect their parish council representatives, little things like that tended to upset the authorities.
Now, I remember that Steve's first article, and we've had him here as a guest on Democracy Now, was sometime last year, wasn't it? Long before the Pope's visit. I know I interviewed you during the period of the Pope's visit, and several other reporters did then. Clearly some reports did talk about a group of hunger strikers in Santa Clara who had been arrested. Could you tell us a little bit about them, how that group developed and how the Cuban government came to apparently believe that news of these hunger strikers was getting out as a result of your work?
Well, there's a small illegal or not recognized political party called the Human Rights Party in Cuba. And so one of their local leaders was sentenced to prison for that activity. So in October of last year, a group of other members and family members and started a hunger strike very quietly in their home, in their living room, to demand the release of that person. But since that was at the same time that the reburial of the remains of Che Guevara and his companions was taking place with extreme solemnity in Santa Clara, they didn't want that hunger strike to be going on. So before the funeral cortege arrived, the police arrested all those hunger strikers, and most were sent to prison for about a year and a half, but continued the hunger strike in prison. So the government was sensitive to that. So I didn't have anything too much to do with them directly, but when foreign reporters would visit me and we would talk off the record, I would also let them know that if they wanted information about that group, where they could go in Santa Clara, who they could talk to, with the people that were had information and were willing to speak to the press about that. So I was sort of an intermediary so that foreign reporters could get in touch with those people or their cooperators.
Father Patrick Sullivan, the criticism of the Cuban government was not only that you had, you know, been talking with the foreign media quite extensively, but that you were meeting with members of the U.S. interest section in Havana. The U.S. interest section is there in lieu of an embassy. Is that true, and why were you in contact with the U.S. interest section?
Well, I think it would be exaggeration to say in contact. When they would pass through Santa Clara to visit returned rafters, people that had left on rafts and been returned forcibly, they would simply stop in to visit the only American in the neighborhood, and we would sit down in the front parlor quite publicly, and I'd give them a cup of coffee, and we'd chew the fat, and they'd move on. So it wasn't a meeting. It was more of a courtesy call. Likewise, it's their job to be fishing for information as much as possible, so they try to get a feel of the situation. But there was nothing official in meeting. It was pretty much a routine drop-in that they would do. I imagine they would have visited any American that happened to be in the area.
As I guess most journalists would, I certainly when I heard there was a Catholic priest from the Bronx in Cuba, I said, I got to get there to visit him. But let me ask you, in terms of been a priest throughout much of Central America over many years. How would you compare everyday life in Cuba, both economically and politically, compared to other areas in Central America where you've served?
Well, certainly economically, the people have the great advantage of having an excellent free universal medical care, even though there are now a lot of shortages of materials and medicines. But the availability of doctors and hospitals for absolutely everyone is extraordinary compared to Central America. Likewise, the universal education, primary education in high school and a lot of university education, again, compared to Central America, is very, very striking. And the political situation was one more of an overall repression, but without the violence, the killings, the political killings that were unfortunately very common in Central America. So it was a politically repressed area, but not with that random violence or brutal violence that unfortunately is more common in some parts of Central America.
Father Sullivan, when I saw Juan's article on you after he interviewed you in Santa Clara, it was quite striking, the places you had been, Nicaragua, Honduras, right at the height of the conflicts there, in particular U.S. interest, and then you end up in Cuba. Can you talk about what you were doing in Nicaragua during the time of the Contras and in Honduras? You also served in El Salvador?
Yes. No, I was always simply a parish priest in all of those areas. But while I was in Nicaragua, the parish was a rural, very extensive parish, so most of the territory of the parish was in the hands of the Contras, and other parts were in the hands of the government. So we worked quite freely in both areas, and the church was generally considered a trusted intermediary between the two groups to negotiate release of prisoners or people who had been kidnapped or people had been arrested. So we pretty much had a trusting relationship with both sides during those last years of the conflict.
I think the clear insinuation from the Cuban government saying, you know, that you had these contacts with the U.S. interest section more than they would have liked was the suggestion that you're working with the U.S. government in Cuba, or perhaps with the Central Intelligence Agency, since they have such an extreme interest in Cuba over the years, having attempted to assassinate Castro I don't know how many times. But did you have contacts with the CIA in Cuba and in the other places that you worked, like the Contra-controlled region in Nicaragua?
No, not that I know of anyway, unless there was somebody I didn't know about. But no, they wouldn't have any, they didn't even hint at that as being an explanation or a reason for the expulsion, because this really wouldn't have been anything at all that would have even given hints of anything of that nature.
Father, one of the amazing, I think, little appreciated changes that have occurred or revolutions that have occurred in Latin America has been how the Catholic Church has gone through such a transformation from being, in years past, basically a bulwark of the elite in each country to being, in many countries now, the refuge for democratic renewal, for social change. Could you talk a little bit about how the church has functioned in Cuba in recent years? Because it did have a checkered past of its relationship to the previous regime. the Batista regime, and how it has evolved and gathered support in recent years in Cuba?
Well, starting back from the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the government backed off somewhat on their previous heavy repression against church practice, basically people started coming back in larger and larger numbers, basically for their spiritual hunger, for some kind of spiritual reality in their lives, but also at the same time people that were discontented politically found that the churches could be a space where they could speak a little more freely. And since in those previous years the churches universal documents from Vatican II or the many talks and writings of the Pope have been much more explicit in favor of human rights and social justice, it tended to be a real source of or an alternative vision of how to recreate society for those that weren't satisfied with the government's version of how to accomplish that.
One of the things I was particularly amazed at was when I attended one of the church services at your church during the Pope's visit. It was an evening, I think it was a Sunday evening Mass, and after the Mass was completed, you announced to all your parishioners that you were going to be showing a film, and it was The Mission with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons, one of my favorite films.
And, me too, and Dan Berrigan, actually.
Yes, and you had a big video screen in the rectory, and then people went in and just sat around and ate and watched this wonderful film. What kinds of activities did you develop in the church that brought? Because you definitely had a large following in that church. What kind of activities did you engage in that perhaps had not been been done in that church previously?
Well, the, making videos available was very popular because the people didn't have too much any access to religiously oriented videos, so they were always greatly in demand. When we showed Dead Man Walking with Spanish subtitles, I think we had to repeat that about 5 times. The people were extremely impressed with that. I guess the only other new activity was that following the diocesan plan to help prisoners, we had a committee so that every person from the parish area, whether they're a believer or not, if they were in prison for any reason, we had a parish volunteer that would visit the family of the prisoner to encourage them, and likewise to send a small supplementary food package to each prisoner once a month. So that was sort of a new activity that people responded to very enthusiastically, and in no shortage of volunteers to do that, to give some support to other families of prisoners.
Father Patrick Sullivan, we only have actually a few seconds left, but you've expressed your opposition to the U.S. blockade against Cuba. Do you have any affection for the Cuban government?
I admire many of the excellent things that they've done. I'm sorry that they feel they have to deprive people of certain liberties in order to do that, but their good intention to make sure that everyone has food, education, medical health is certainly a very admirable thing.
And you're now working in New York?
Temporarily. I'll be going back to Honduras probably in August.
Well, thank you very much for being with us and agreeing to this first radio interview you've done, Father Patrick Sullivan, who has just recently left Cuba. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Joe Gill, our engineer in Washington. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. From the studios of WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!